Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Robeson's Incorporated, Champaign; EAG Company Incorporated, Fairmount; AgriGold Hybrids, Mahomet; and Command Performance Research Incorporated, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Michigan State has a home and state advantage, and bettors are getting sentimental about Villanova, but sports books in Nevada still clearly favor North Carolina to win the NCAA tournament. Oddsmaker Mike Sebo of Las Vegas Sports Consultants says that Carolina was a 10-11 favorite to win this title. That means a bettor must gamble $11 to win $10 if the Tar Heels take the championship. Connecticut is 9-5, while Michigan State and Villanova are each at 4-1 odds to win the title. Sabas says UConn is favored to beat Michigan State by 4 points in their semifinal, even though the teams play in Detroit. Carolina is favored by Villanova by 7.5 points. Sabas says Villanova's wins over UCLA and Duke have made the Wildcats popular among bettors. The University of Memphis has given Kentucky permission to speak to coach John Calipari about the Wildcats' head coaching position. Athletic Director R.C. Johnson said in a statement today that Calipari could meet with Kentucky representatives, but stressed Memphis will do whatever it can to retain the coach. Calipari did not immediately return a text message from the Associated Press, and several Memphis players did not respond to email messages left by the AP. And in football news, offensive tackle Marvell Smith has signed a 2-year deal with the 49ers of San Francisco, who expect him to be their starting right tackle. Smith spent the first 9 seasons in with the Pittsburgh Steelers, starting 108 regular season games and making the Pro Bowl after the 2005 season. He's also started 10 postseason games and earned 2 Super Bowl rings. That's a look at sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign, with plaques and promotional products to recognize all occasions from athletic endeavors and musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com.
Retailers are also having a tough time in this economy. Many are reducing staff to save money. At the same time, they need remaining staff to be friendlier and more helpful than ever to keep customers coming in and keep them buying. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports from Seattle on how companies are seeking to balance cost-cutting and customer service.
The Bellevue Square Mall is the largest retail complex on Seattle's so-called East Side, a collection of mostly affluent, in some cases downright rich, neighborhoods. But even here, stores are closing. There are noticeably fewer shoppers, and the shopping experience is decidedly mixed. Mall visitor Pat O'Brien says many salespeople are more helpful now than in the past.
There aren't as many customers, for one thing, and they have more time with you. And I heard, one salesperson say it's been 12 minutes since somebody came in that door. So you are going to get more attention if there is a salesperson there.
Small boutiques have typically had attentive staff, but now, says Keisha Eister, that attentiveness has gone over the top.
I think the salespeople are like more pushy and in your face now because they need to sell you something now because they need you to buy something. They need the revenue. I think that's changed.
Other shoppers complain about the absence of help in some of the larger stores. Retail and investment consultant Patricia Edwards pays close attention to the financial metrics of retailers, but she also takes a consumer's point of view into the shopping mall.
I would say for the majority of the retailers, service has probably gone down.
Sales and customer service employees cost money. The cost of labor is one of the few areas in which retailers have complete control. They can't turn off the lights or cut inventory beyond a certain point, but they can eliminate staff. But Edwards says companies that cut too deeply are likely to see their sales suffer.
In this type of an economy, people don't want to spend at all. When they do spend, they want the experience to go along with the goods. And if the experience isn't good, they may not buy anything, even if they need the apparel or whatever else it is they're selling.
Two recent surveys suggest that companies that have scored well in customer satisfaction over the past few years continue to be viewed favorably, while many companies near the bottom of the list may be getting worse. Online merchants, including L.L. Bean, Amazon, and Zappos, continue to score at or near the top in terms of customer satisfaction among retailers. But the data compiled by Big Research revealed something that may surprise you. The number 7 spot, the highest of any department store, went to J.C. Penney.
Hi, do you need any help here? Just listen right now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chelsea's right here. She can help you with anything you need.
Bill Trentinero, the manager of Penny's in Bellevue Square, is walking the sales floor. He's wearing a headset that allows him to be in constant contact with his assistants, cashiers, and sales staff. He says the company's high ranking in the survey is no accident. About a year ago, Penny's made a commitment to improve customer service nationwide. The headset, new training, and daily online assessments by shoppers are just some of what the store manager calls the little things that make a difference.
The sum of all of it is a lot of work and investment in it. Systems have changed. We have technology that's changed. We have reports that we use to tell us how we're doing that are new. So there's a lot of pieces that have gone into this.
Forrester research analyst Bruce Temkin says many retailers are struggling now to find the right balance between service and cutting costs. Understanding what its customers value most is essential to that effort. What makes sense for a discounter like Walmart may make no sense at all for a high-end department store. But even within categories, says Temkin, companies are making different choices.
I think when we come out of the recession, you're going to have a number of companies who retain strong relationships with their customers, and you're going to have a bunch of them that have a much weaker relationships with their customers.
You can guess, he says, which firms are likely to do better once the economy picks up. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
One of the most famous episodes in relations between Washington and Moscow took place a half century ago at the 1959 American Exhibition in the Soviet capital. That's where a debate took place between Vice President Richard Nixon and Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. It was known as the Kitchen Debate, and the event is special significance for NPR Moscow correspondent Gregory Pfeiffer.
Vice President Nixon escorts Soviet Premier Khrushchev on a preview of the United States Fair at Skolniki Park in Moscow.
Barely 6 years after the death of dictator Joseph Stalin ended the worst Soviet repressions, more than 2 million people thronged a leafy Moscow park, where pavilions brimmed with the latest American consumer goods. Braving a broiling summer sun, they gawked at Polaroid cameras, the latest washing machines, and a model house. The American goal was to blow Soviet minds into accepting the superiority of capitalism over communism. Standing in a model kitchen next to the portly, combative Khrushchev on opening day, Nixon suggested the United States was ahead of the Soviet Union in some areas. He used as an example the development of color videotape, which was recording their meeting.
This indicates the possibilities of increasing communication. And this increase in communication will teach us some things, and it will teach you some things, too. Because after all, you don't know everything.
Khrushchev wasn't having any of it. The Soviets were ahead in most areas, he insisted. And anyway, the video would probably be used for propaganda back in the United States.
What I have to say is being translated only into your ear, but the American people will never hear it.
At times, it seemed Khrushchev had spent his entire political life preparing for that opportunity to demolish the apparent benefits of capitalism. But at the time, most Americans believed Nixon won the debate. However, for many of the young Americans serving as guides at the exhibition, the major interest was their once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to experience the Soviet Union, a state portrayed back home as their mortal enemy. That's one of the guides standing next to a Ford Thunderbird, recorded in a documentary of the exhibition by filmmaker D.A. Pennebaker. The guide happens to be my father, George Pfeiffer. He says he found himself spending far less time answering questions about the car than about the American school system and other aspects of American life.
There was this great sea of affection for the American people. There was also, among these supposedly downtrodden and oppressed peoples, as we incessantly were told, a great deal of humanity and originality and humor.
At the front gates, visitors stood in line for hours to get into the exhibition, where many got their first taste of Pepsi Cola.
It was very difficult to get to anything then.
Tatiana Stepanova was a 16-year-old Muscovite in 1959. She's also my mother. She says the most crowded displays were those where the American guide spoke freely and with a sense of humor.
I just somehow sensed how free that country was through their gestures, through the way they behaved, through the way they were dressed. You just could see that these were free people, and we were not.
At the Ford display, my future mother asked my future dad a question about American jazz that he was unable to answer. But he got her to return the next day by giving her one of the most craved items in Moscow that summer, an exhibition pass that meant she wouldn't have to line up again. They eventually married, and she left the Soviet Union. The current American ambassador to Russia, John Byerly, was a college student when he got his first guide job at a later exhibition in 1977. He says the exhibitions gave millions of Soviets a chance to hear young Americans speaking without Soviet censorship.
The impact it had on pushing back against some of the worst of the anti-American propaganda pushed by the Soviet Union in those days is hard to calculate. But I know that it had an effect on a lot of people because I've met some of these people now coming back as ambassador.
Still, Byerly says the exhibitions also showed the limits of personal connections. He believes they can't overcome profound misunderstandings between the two cultures. Today, most observers say the level of hostility and distrust toward America and Americans among ordinary Russians is much stronger than it was when Nixon debated Khrushchev 50 years ago.
Every aspect of the Cold War and Soviet-American rivalry is argued in blunt and forthright terms.
Whatever the limits of cultural diplomacy, the participants in the American exhibitions believe they can be a useful model for President Obama as he seeks to improve ties with Moscow. Those personal contacts between ordinary Americans and Russians, even during the bitter days of the Cold War, benefited U.S. foreign policy, not to mention this radio correspondent. Gregory Pfeiffer, NPR News, Moscow.
April 1st is a day of celebration for those who enjoy satire, but it can be a day of upset for those who are the targets of such satire, and a court is sometimes asked to sort it all out. Here's commentator Amy Guida with this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
If you read in the newspaper that a six-year-old girl had been shackled and put in jail after writing a book report about the children's picture book titled Where the Wild Things Are, would you believe it? What if the story reported that the judge ordered the six-year-old detained for 10 days, saying that it was time for the United States to stop treating kids like children? And that the paper also suggested that the charges came after officials at the six-year-old's elementary school found the acts of cannibalism, fanaticism, and disorderly conduct outlined in her book report troubling and dangerous. Take a look at the date before you answer. It's April Fool's Day week, a period in which many come to expect the pulling of legs and the goofiest of jokes, even from the most reputable of sources, like, say, the local newspaper. Some reporters and editors traditionally share a good laugh this week, creating a fake front page or fake inside pages that mock or mislead, all in good fun. The only trouble is that some readers aren't laughing. These are the people who believe the April Fool's pages to be not a mockery, but fact. These can also be the people mocked in the article. If the article's focus is a real person, he or she may not be laughing either. Take the newspaper in California that included in its April Fool's parody edition a fake letter to the editor written by a real local landlord. The letter suggested that he used electroshock therapy to keep his tenants in line. Or the newspaper in Connecticut that suggested that a real local developer planned to build a 250,000-square-foot store and the state's largest restaurant with scantily clad waitresses near a local school and church. Okay, perhaps we had to be there to see the humor. And that's all part of the analysis when those mocked file defamation lawsuits against the newspapers. As the court in the California case explained, the issue was whether the average reader reading that paper would have recognized the material as a joke. That average reader can't be, in one court's words, a dullard. He or she appreciates satire. And that standard is why most courts rule in favor of the newspapers in these April Fool's Edition cases. If it's a parody, courts have explained in so many words, it can't be defamatory, because the average reader understands that it's all made up, and a made-up article can't damage one's reputation. That story about the six-year-old girl's book report, that was a parody, too, written for a Texas newspaper. Readers who believed the news story wrote angry letters to the judge and the prosecutor, threatening their removal from office. But even there, the Texas Supreme Court refused to find the newspaper liable for defamation. Some people, it wrote, even believed stories in the satirical newspaper The Onion. But those aren't the reasonable ones. Put another way, they are April Fools. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois. Coming up next on PRI's The World, battering and honor killings go lightly punished in Syria, and few women speak openly about abuse. PRI's The World visits Syria's only government-supported shelter for abused women. Domestic violence in Syria and the day's news coming up next on The World, beginning at 3.
Earth and Sky.
In early 2009, the United Nations announced new population estimates. Earth Sky spoke with Hanya Zlotnik, director of the UN Population Division. She said the world is still on course to have 9 billion people by 2050. That's in contrast to nearly 6.8 billion today.
If we really get to 9 billion, after that, we might not change very much. It might stay between 9 and 10 billion over the rest of the century, maybe more.
Population scientists use the word fertility to describe the total number of children for each woman. Fertility is highest in the developing world, but the birth rate there is declining, and the decline is expected to continue. Meanwhile, people are living longer.
Thanks to antibiotics, to better hygiene, mortality has declined in an amazing way in all the world.
Zlotnik pointed out that an aging global population is inevitable in a world where people live longer as birth rates decline. She thinks that's a good thing.
If the population were not aging, it would be increasing at much faster rates and therefore putting much more pressure on the environment than it is putting already. So it is a necessary outcome of eventual sustainability of population numbers.
We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible by Carl Foundation Hospital. Carl Foundation Hospital provided more than $80 million in community benefit last year, including almost $10 million in free or discounted care. More information about how Carl embraces its charitable mission is in its annual report at carl.org.
Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana. This afternoon, we expect partly to mostly sunny skies, highs ranging from around 40 near Lake Michigan to 64 in far southern Illinois. Tonight in Illinois, increasing clouds with showers and a few thunderstorms arriving in the west and spreading to the east. In Indiana, becoming partly cloudy, lows ranging from 34 in the north to 50 in southern Illinois. Tomorrow in western Illinois, rain ending early, becoming partly sunny. In eastern Illinois and in Indiana, expect cloudy skies.